Coming up.
Over the crest of one of the waves, looking for a wave to catch. On the wave, busy forming, I saw a great white shark.
Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, not a lot goes through your mind when you see the apex predator of the ocean.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. My name is Dr. Suhail Essa, and we are here to discuss another interesting guest's life. Joined with me in the studio, we have a man named Caleb Swanepoel, who is a shark attack survivor. Thank you for joining us, Caleb.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks.
Cool to be here.
Glad you could make it. So I was told that you're a surfer.
I am. One of the things I enjoy doing.
What are the things that you enjoy doing? Tell us.
But just on the surfing thing, everyone thinks shark attack must have been a surfer. Yeah. And I suppose we'll go back to the story, but I only learned to surf after I lost my leg.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. But some of the interesting things, I mean, Flop, I think we all like to watch films. So Netflix mm-hmm. is on that list, I think, mm-hmm. of things to do when I'm not busy. I'm a tea drinker. I enjoy moving my body. I enjoy exercise. Okay. I love human connection, so meeting new people.
Okay.
I love storytelling. Mm-hmm. One of the things I do is acting as well. So I studied acting, and that's currently what I'm the field I'm working in.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a little bit of speaking as well, sharing this story and on platforms like this. Mm-hmm. So, but I think we're all diverse people, right? There's probably a lot of other things there that I haven't mentioned.
Oh, we'll delve deeper. We can go deep.
Just don't psychoanalyze me.
No. Don't worry. We're going to get to that.
That's why we're here.
That's why we're here. We'll get to that later.
Did you bite the shark, or did the shark bite you?
Clearly. Clearly, that would be answered.
You're just asking me, bit the shark.
It's a psychoanalysis.
No, but I mean, if we get metaphorical about it, then we could always work a way that I've bitten the shark. But no, the shark definitely bit me, and I came out second best. Yeah. Okay. But I came out alive. So
yeah,
I just saw a reel while I was waiting for you guys to finish your other guest, about. Someone was talking about suffering in life, and I suppose this is stuff that you guys are confronted with your jobs and the people that you work with.
Yeah.
And, you save lives and you help lives and you help improve lives. But part of life is suffering, right? So if you are grateful to be alive, are you also grateful for suffering? I suppose it's an open-ended question that I can think about answering. But sorry, that's random. My mind also revels self-diagnosed ADHD, so... Yeah.
No, that's very interesting. I mean, I obviously we want to get down to that story, right?
Like, yes, of course.
But I think should we nice get to into that story, or should we first start off like we normally do and just ask you about, like, where are you from? Let's start with the basics.
So we're starting with that one.
Yes.
Yeah. Start, where are you from?
I'm from the dusty streets of Prince Albert, which is a tiny little town in the Karoo, mm-hmm. in the Western Cape. So if you've done the garden route, you would have gone past George. We're 2 hours inland from George. If you've
Prince Albert,
not the piercing, named after the royal family when they came over.
Mm. Okay.
From
dreary. How big is this town?
I've never heard of it.
When I got there, I think it was about 10,000 people. If you go to Woolworths and you...
Oh, they have a Woolworths?
No. No, this is how I'm going to...
There's no Woolworths in Prince Albert.
No, there's no Woolworths. There's a spa.
Okay.
So you'll get... And my aunt's restaurant. So between those two, and there's a bed. So if you need accommodation, we'll sort you out as well.
A bed.
And my mom has a school, so we'll also educate you. So it's a one-stop shop for a barefoot education. But if you go on the N1 and you go past Lanesburg, before you get to Beaufort West, you'll turn right and you'll find Prince Albert. So Karoo lamb comes from Prince Albert. We have really good fruit that comes from Prince Albert, nuts. So it's a farming community and it's become quite olive oil. So mm-hmm. my story with the Woolworths story was if you go to... Woolworths and you go by the olive oil, you'll see there's a yellow tin that's very bougie looking, and that's Prince Albert olive oil from the town I'm from.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So it's
small world, eh? I always wondered.
That's yellow tin.
that yellow one.
Now I've helped you figure out a puzzle.
Makes sense.
But Prince Albert's, I would say it's a bit of an art hub for artists and local, you know, storytellers. Mm-hmm. It's a place where people can escape the city, you know, Cape Town is a holiday destination, but mm-hmm. for those that are retiring.
So how far is it from Cape Town?
About 3 hours and 45 minutes, okay. 3 hours 30 if you drive a little bit faster.
Okay.
There is average speeding, but you know, you can, in between, you can go.
So you say it's like a hub for arts, so people leave Cape Town and come to Prince Albert?
I would say people retire there, and and they artists go and produce their work there, and there's galleries there.
Yeah.
And then we also have the farming community. So originally it was a farming community, and then it kind of grew into this sort of beautiful destination. It's got the Swartberg Pass at the foot of the town, which is a national heritage site.
Yes, yes. I think I've been to that town, hey? But
everyone says that. Like, I think I've driven through that town.
I remember doing Garden Route and passing a town where they said the lamb here is out of this world.
That's every Karoo town, though, but maybe.
Could be. But
you would have had to go over either through Meringspoort, which is also a pass, a tarred pass, asphalt, or over the dirt road that comes over into Prince Albert.
I think it was a dirt road, but there was a pass before we got to the...
Yes, we would have come down a beautiful winding pass.
Yes,
Lots of mountain bikers like to go there.
Okay.
Yeah, so
I think I've passed it. And what you're describing is actually what I saw in that town. It's a very small town.
Yeah.
It looks like a very close-knit sort of community. Everyone knows everyone because we were driving... We're actually doing... it was a campaign, like a car sort of showing off a car and testing the car and influencer stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they took us to that town just for like a lunch while we were passing to driving back from the garden, like Garden Route to Joburg. Yeah.
A lot of tour groups come through there.
Yeah,
A lot of biking groups come through there because it's a beautiful place to stay.
Yeah.
If you're foreign as well, there's lots of, you know, South Africa is quite an attractive place for foreigners for spending your cash.
Yeah.
So people buy property there, they'll use it as their second destination, so they'll do summer here, and then they'll go do summer in Europe. And it's not like a Cape Town, it's not a big city, so you have to also accept that people are going to remember your name and see you at the local coffee shop and come and maybe sit down when you're trying to read your book. And but I think that the antithesis of that, or the flip side of that, is there's community support, right? So there's a little local marquee on a Saturday with the best pancakes. You've got your local restaurants, your local businesses. You've got grassroots education. I was homeschooled in Prince Albert.
Okay.
Yeah, from grade 5. So I don't know what age that would be. I'd say 10, 11. I was, my mom took us out of school. She didn't want to send us to George or to Cape Town because we were settled in Prince Albert. She had 5 kids.
Yeah.
And, I mean, education also costs. So she had studied... education through UNISA, and started teaching at the local school, and also started homeschooling us.
Oh wow!
So yeah, I'm actually doing.
So wait, she'd teach at the school, but then she'd be like, "You guys aren't going there."
No. So she taught at the school.
Uh huh.
We were at the local school, and then when I got to grade 5, so from grade 2 to 5, she taught at the school, and then she was like, "Cool," because my brother by that time was going into high school.
Yeah.
He was 2 years older than me, so when he was going into high school, my mom pulled us all out and said, cool, kitchen table, here's your work. And then so many friends and family joined that, you know, you can't run a school from your kitchen table. It's illegal once you hit a certain amount of pupils, learners.
Yeah.
And so she registered Albert College, and now it's a non-profit organization that doesn't make any money. It never did anyway, but employs teachers, Cambridge facility. We all did Cambridge, so up to AS or A level, and place kids all over the world, all over the globe. But I mean, up to 40, 50 kids max a year. So from grade R all the way through to high school.
That's crazy. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a really amazing mom, eh?
Yeah, I think it's just a testament to parents, of what parents are capable of doing, and I think what mothers are also capable of doing. I'm actually doing a Mother's Day insert with my mom next week, and we're going to be bonding together we're going to be doing an interview together. My mom's a little bit nervous of being on screen and having a microphone, but I want my mom's story to be told, because my story gets told a lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, I definitely don't think, you know, I haven't made it on any level at all, but I do stand on the shoulders of giants. Yeah. You know, I do stand on the people that have come before me.
And tell us, like, okay, so how'd you end up in Prince Albert? And then how'd you leave?
Family was working in, the Western Cape. My dad was working in Cape Town. My mom was working with my dad, and then started raising a family. We then went to Ruby Castile, which is where Peter Steph de Toy, if you know Peter Steph, is one of our best mock players. He was actually in grade 7 when I was in grade 1 in Rubia Castile, which is about an hour and 15, I would say, from Cape Town. And then my grandparents moved to Prince Albert. And my mom went and visited, and her sister also moved there and started teaching. So my mom's side of the family kind of gravitated towards that town. We ended up starting to visit, and just ended up being our destination of childhood, I guess. Okay. And then we would come through to Cape Town, school holidays, we'd go to the beach, we'd go to George a lot, Victoria Bay. So, but I mean, lots of hiking in the mountains, doing my own exercise, running, sharing the local tennis courts with the bullies on a Saturday. We played hockey on the rugby field. Just, you know, I do think that part of me would have enjoyed the typical boys' school camaraderie and environment. That's the one thing I think I would go back and try and inject in one of my years. But I think for the most part, I've had a really good education and a really good upbringing.
Are there any black people in?
There are. I mean, it's
like they own property, not working.
Yes, there are people who own property. Okay. We have, but traditionally it was a large coloured community and a white community because of the farming structure. But I haven't done a demographic deep dive into who owns property there.
But it is.
It's a small town, man. Small towns have structures that are still developing and changing and integrating. But that's a great question. No one's ever asked me that, how many black people own property. But I'm not a property developer there. But if I do ever become one, I'll give you the stats.
And your mom's school?
Yeah.
Right? Are there any black people there?
Yes. Black, colored, white. Okay. Girls,
no, it's not. I'm just curious. No, it's such a beautiful town. If it's the one that I'm thinking about, right? And when I was there, I didn't really see any.
Yes.
And I was like,
but how long were you there for? You
know, like just one night.
You got to look carefully. Yeah, yeah. You know,
there were a lot of
You got to look in the mirror.
Yeah, you got to come to Albert College.
It's tough there.
From the ground up, you're raising everyone.
It's tough. But I mean, the ones that I did, I mean, I basically went to one place, so. You know, whatever I'm saying is really. Yeah,
but I mean, it's not going to be like Johannesburg. You know?
Of course,
it's not the city of gold or the town of gold. So,
yeah.
It's like I said, structurally there's been a specific structure in the town for a very long time. Yeah. We all know the history that we've come from, and as a result, it has a specific structure which is slowly changing and becoming more integrated.
Okay.
But I think. I don't know what it feels like as a person of color stepping into a white town and what that feels like and not seeing someone who represents me. But I've never been asked that before. So thanks for asking that.
No, you'll think about it now. Next time you're there, you'll be like,
Mom,
there's something wrong here.
Or there's something right.
Or there's something right. Yeah. Exactly. There could be something right.
I think it is good. I think it is really good to look at our spaces and kind of just stop and have a bit of perspective, you know, and ask yourself that question. And I love photos of you know, like weddings and birthdays and anniversaries, and you look at the table and like who's around the table at like La Parada or Tiger's Milk, and it's interesting to see how diverse friend groups are as well. I'm very lucky that I was able to go and study in Cape Town, which also kind of expanded my friend group and the people that I was surrounded by, and also different ways of seeing the world, you know, even building friendships, building relationships, what maybe through your childhood you've learned certain ways of doing things or seeing things that maybe just don't sit right with someone, and having to, you know, adjust and be more dynamic in social environments. And I'm sure you guys have to do that with your work.
All the time, definitely.
All the time.
I think let's get to the meat. Meat of all of this.
Well, or the lack thereof.
There's still lots of meat.
But anyway, so you moved to Cape Town. You're a student. You're studying drama, dramatic arts, theater and performing arts at UCT, I'm assuming?
Yes, UCT, hitting campus,
And Yeah, well, then what happened?
Yeah, man.
I'm sure the shark didn't jump out at the steps at the UCT.
No, Jamie Stairs, no. Yeah. So it was actually my first semester break. So middle of the year, June holidays, schools are out, universities are out. And I was 19 at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as a young man, when you're 19, you're 18, 19, you're developing your sense of what it means to be a man in the world, what it looks like. Mm-hmm. I've also moved from a small town to the city, so mm-hmm. expanding that worldview, I guess, and now doing a very creative degree that really stretches you to, I don't know, move your body, work with different texts, and also just think outside the box. So lots of stuff happening in the mind and in the body, and you know, also questioning, is this the right thing for me? This is not, you know, Hugh Jackman as the Wolverine. It's breath work and movement classes and stretching and things like that. So really learning the fundamentals and the basics of acting. And my family go to a beach called Buffalo Bay, which is between Victoria Bay and Knysna. Mm-hmm. So it was the first time we were going there. It was recommended by a friend from Prince Albert's, who's a really good friend of ours. And
He's still a great friend.
Yeah, his name is Paul.
Because I would block him on WhatsApp. I'm not
gonna I can't. He's like my grandfather, and yeah, he's a wonderful person. But that, yeah, I hadn't made the correlated joke until now. But we went to this new beach called Buffalo Bay. We'd been there for a week already, and I'd swam every single day. I was running on the beach. I was doing my own workouts, my own exercises. My mom and dad were there, my sisters were there, and then my brothers came because they were at Varsity College and they just finished their semester and they came to join us. And I don't know if any of you guys are brothers.
Four, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, you'll know potentially what it's like to be, you know, challenged a little bit, and you want to keep up with your brothers. You want to kind of do the same thing they're doing as well if you're all hanging out. And my brothers arrived and they said, cool, we're going to go body surfing. So no bodyboard, no surfboard. We weren't surfers. We were very good at body surfing though. So just catching a wave with your body, wetsuit, fin. And we went out right down from the beach house. So my mom, my sisters, my brother's girlfriends, the dog, everyone was just chilling on the grass, watching us go into the water. And we went about 50 meters out, 50, 60 meters out. Surfers were coming in as you went out. And we went to a little spot called Murphy's Point, which was this little sandbank where the surfers were surfing all morning. We'd wake up and watch people surf. So we went out quite far, couldn't stand. Brothers wanted to catch big waves. It's like, cool, let's go. And we were out for about 30, 40 minutes, and we decided we're going to catch one more wave, one or two more waves. And you also spread out in the ocean. You aren't right in a klombie together. Mm. And then we were kind of looking for waves. And if you body surfing, you neck deep, so you don't really have much height to actually sight for the wave that's going to hopefully that you can catch. So you kind of wait every single time the tide kind of lifts you and drops you. And as I came over the crest of one of the waves, looking for a wave to catch, on the wave busy forming, I saw a great white shark.
Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, not a lot goes through your mind when you see the apex predator of the ocean. I literally just turned to my brothers instinctively and said, there's a shark, swim. And we just put our heads down and started swimming towards the beach. And I had this feeling that it was going to be me. And next thing I knew, this thing just slammed into me. And sometimes, you know, with a great white, it'll stun its prey with its nose. So it'll come in quite hard. And obviously it hit me and then, you know, bit into me, and at this point in time, I completely disconnected from my body. I thought, this is a dream. This is not real. I had a completely out of body experience, and literally a drone shot of the attack from above. And then from being disconnected, I remember having a very practical thought because I was studying a theatre degree and needed my body for movement. I told myself, no, this is just a dream. You clearly are just dreaming. Got pulled back down into the attack, tried to hit the shark off my leg. And I always say it was like a like a vice-like grip. There was no way I could get it off my leg. Try to hit it, try to push it off, and had a moment as well under the water where I was submerged and I was ready to go. That was my NDE, I guess you would say, where I asked the universe, okay, I'm this is it. And I was quite calm and curious at the same time, and just asked, am I going to see a white light now? Like, is that what's coming? And almost this moment of suspension where everything just stood still completely, and I was really ready to go, you know. And then something disconnected, and obviously I didn't know, but my right leg had been taken off completely above the knee, and my younger brother, who was sharing a pair of fins with me, his name is Alexander, but we call him Sandy. So Sands turned around and saw that I wasn't next to him, because him and I were sharing a pair of fins, and then he saw me getting attacked, and then he swam back towards me, which was also a bit of a miracle. Not because my brother doesn't love me, but because if I had to put myself in the situation, I don't know if fear would keep me still or force me to act. But he just swam back towards me. When he got to me, kind of held on to me, steadied me, and I asked him, like, how bad is it? And he looked down and saw my leg was gone. And he said, you've got a scratch. You're going to be fine. So he calmed me down completely, and then started directing us back towards the beach and said, cool, like, let's swim. Started swimming back towards the beach, stopped us again, and the shark came back and had circled us. So I have a laceration on my left side as well. And then my brother scared the shark off, or the shark eventually swam away, and my brother came out of the water with a bite mark out of his fin, and I came out of the water with my leg gone. And my mom ran into the water because she saw everything happen. My sisters, everyone saw everything happen. They first saw this black back in the water and then just blood. They saw us swimming away and then just blood. They didn't know which of us had been bitten or what was happening. And then was dragged onto the beach, blacked out. Everything went white, and I had this sort of noise, just like almost white noise in my ears. And then slowly heard the voices come back, and then woke up on the beach and my family was around me. My mom's hand was on my chest, and her hand was on my chest, but also my wetsuit was still on, and it was like I couldn't breathe. I actually had to cut my wetsuit open to allow me to breathe. And my brother said I had these yellow rings around my eyes when I was in the ocean. Like, I don't know, you know, what that means medically. Maybe that was what he saw in the moment. And also white as a sheet, just lost so much blood. And so the miracle that happened that day was that I didn't bleed out. I should have bled out, you know, within 5 minutes. You know, severed femoral artery, and mine actually contracted, went into spasm, and they tourniqueted my leg on the beach. But I mean, without the spasm of the
that archery,
I think it would have been gone, because I was on the beach for about 45 minutes before the NSRI came, who had notified a chopper that had landed in Oterun, and which was about an hour away. But the chopper landed in the parking lot. They first put me on a surfboard, carried me all the way up to the house, then put me on a then put me in the ambulance. But before I got into the ambulance, they were kind of packaging me, I guess. I don't know what the terminology is there, but they were kind of getting me ready for the ambulance to take me to the chopper.
Yeah.
And that's when I started feeling pain, because there was no pain with the initial bite. Obviously, there's initial impact, but then no pain. And I mean, my whole leg like was just got, I mean, snapped through the femur bone, bit my whole right leg off above the knee, and you feel no pain. That still is baffling for me to understand. And then I started feeling this pain come when I was lying on the surfboard. And I remember feeling, I thought my ass had been bitten, because it just went up into my glutes. And I didn't even feel this. I didn't even know that this had happened. I don't think anyone had noticed this. And I asked them, can you give me something for the pain? But because I'd lost so much blood, I think you can go into cardiac arrest if they give you morphine.
Yeah. So there's certain, like, especially opioids, which tend to drop your blood pressure further. You would obviously try and avoid it if someone already has a...
I passed out as the chopper lifted, as it took us to George Medi Clinic.
Yeah.
I passed out. And I don't know if at that point I'd been given something to help me pass out, or if I just passed out from shock, or if it was a combination of things. And then I woke up very, very delirious in hospital. And I had planned, one of the funny things I always laugh about is I had planned to get my wisdom teeth taken out. So I said to the nurse, like, take out my wisdom teeth when I go into theatre. I was like very serious about it. That's clearly the drugs speaking, whatever they gave me. And yeah, I mean, like I said, back to that life of suffering thing, I think, and one of the things that this person mentioned when they were talking is that if you've experienced pain or loss, hopefully not perpetual, because that probably keeps you in a space where you see no hope. But if you are given an opportunity to overcome something and you build grit, I guess, but have experienced something and have built from that, I think what it's done for me is I think I see other people's challenges and what they've gone through and their stories, and I can resonate to some degree, and I don't necessarily feel sorry for someone, but there's almost like an I see you, not going into the avatar world space, but I see you as an, okay, that sucks, but like, fuck man, you're here, you know, and you're still carrying on.
Yeah.
I met a lady who, yesterday, because there was no power, so go to a coffee shop and work if you can. I'm very lucky that I could go to a coffee shop and work. And she recognized me and we spoke a little bit. And then she told me about her story, and she wears special compression garments that she buys from the UK because she has lymphedema.
Yeah.
Lymphedema.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just someone who has to, she told me she has to exercise every single day. She doesn't always know how to talk about it at work always, because not everyone will always see it and understand.
It's quite a rare condition. Yeah.
Yeah. So just back to, I suppose, having overcome something and being able to reflect on it, I think I have never been exposed to so many other people's journeys of overcoming stuff. And it's only really because I have come through this. So it's almost like the universe is like, cool, we're taking your leg, like, welcome to the crippled world. But here's other things that are going to come into your space. I mean, I wouldn't be having this conversation, right, if this hadn't happened to me. Yeah. And if I could go back and get my leg, I think I'd probably say, yeah, cool, give me my leg, and I won't take it for granted as much as I probably was at that age. But I also know that there's no going back. And I have my shit days. Like, I'm a human being, you know. Like, yes, I'm positive now. I'm sharing my story. We all bonding and connecting. But I still wake up in the morning sometimes and feel like, fuck, man. Like, I don't want to do this. Or, oh, when is this, like, abscess going to go away? Because I've got friction. Or people think also you lose your leg. Here's a prosthetic.
Yeah, all sorted.
Bullshit, you know. So I think there's also an opportunity outside of getting angry about life to also educate people and show people, okay, this is how I've adapted. This is what I've done. This is what I'm learning. And you guys know with your patients, it's an ongoing relationship. So with my prosthetist, her name is Lisa Marie, and she's become like a sister, because I'll have to send her dodgy photos of whatever's happening with the socket sometimes. My skin got pinched here, or I've got an ingrown that's now become infected. Or we need to sort this thing out, or I've got a pressure sore or something, right? Or I've got bruising on the base of my leg, depending on what I've been doing, or if there's bone growth. And I will always need input from a professional. I will always need help. And to acknowledge that is tough, you know, because...
Sorry to cut you, but...
I veered off way from the story.
That's okay. You're an amazing storyteller, by the way. That's why we're not stopping you. I just want to find out, right? I'm just taking you back to when this happened. Did you at any stage scream? Did you at any stage,
I don't know. I think I did. I think when it was happening, I did. But I don't remember screaming.
What do you remember seeing? Did you see the whole shock?
Saw the whole shock in the, and also this is my story post-attack.
Yeah.
So I'm also very curious. I'll answer that now, but I'm very curious to have a bird's eye view of what happened that day. And I don't know necessarily what the best strategy is for that. You know, maybe plant medicine one day. Maybe I'll go to Brazil and do ayahuasca. But to be able to really kind of go back to that moment and go back to the attack or the bite and work through it is sometimes challenging. People ask me for my story, but I don't know if I'm always the best person to be telling it factually, because it's it was happening to me.
Yeah, you know.
It's like when you have people blank out. There's sometimes a blank space there. Okay. So I think there's a couple of little blank squares as to what it looks like,
and you dissociate.
Is it a fugue state? Would it be a fugue state?
Yeah, mentally. I think. I mean, your body can only handle so much shock.
Yeah. So to answer your question, sorry, I want to go back, because this is very interesting for me, because I'm learning stuff here about the fugue state.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the shark, I saw the shark. I somehow just knew it was a shark. I hadn't seen a lot of sharks before, but I just knew it was a shark. Almost like nature was doing its thing. I was the gazelle and the lion was there. Like, I could smell the lion's sweat, you know. There was no lion, and I'm not a
gazelle. No, we understand.
I'm the sardine or the seal, I guess. And I had one fin, also interesting. So, but...
Only one leg, one fin.
No, one leg, one fin. Both two legs, one fin. But...
How big is this?
Did the shark think that maybe I could have been mistaken for a seal? But the fact that it came back for the second time is interesting, because human flesh doesn't taste that great, apparently, for sharks. So some of the researchers have said that they think it was a juvenile shark that was quite curious and investigating, because usually a shark will bite and release. Yeah. So it bit and then came back. But also my brother came back. There was still a lot of blood. So I saw the shark. I felt its skin. I remember feeling just this muscle and then like the sandpaper type feeling. Yeah. But body, like not very much alive. And that's it. And that's it, yeah. Sorry, and I interrupted your fugue state explanation.
So, so basically, I just wanted to highlight the fact that, we see a lot of patients who've sometimes it's not even head injury. Sometimes it's a very traumatic, like a car accident. And then they get this sort of retrograde amnesia.
Completely dissociative state.
Yes.
When you're treating them or when the event happens?
When the event happens.
Okay.
So when you ask them of the story of what happened, some of them will tell you, I can't remember. Some will have bits and pieces.
Generally afterwards, like they'll say, okay, in that moment, I completely blacked out. But then afterwards, maybe a week after, they're like, oh, now I remember. It's like all coming back to me now. Because your body at the time is not sort of registering what's happening immediately in the short term. And then as time goes on, through therapy or through, various different methods, the mind starts to reveal to itself what transpired. Mm-hmm.
So our bodies essentially remember. Does the body keep the score?
It's a good question. I think to some extent, I'm sure it does. I think it's interesting you mentioned like plant medicine and like psychedelics, because I'm sure that there's definitely something in there that could assist.
Yeah,
I think there's definitely some other realm that we haven't tapped into as medical professionals. No. That
and even like an NDE, right? I don't say it lightly. Like a near-death experience, we aren't always given those in life.
Yeah,
and like I sometimes call mine a death experience. I sometimes say like I was reborn on the 27th of June in 2015, because outside of all the things you have to learn and how you change and all that and how your mind changes, just I believed I was going to die. Mm-hmm. So if I believed that in its certainty past going, I know this is going to happen, like it was happening.
Yeah.
So it was almost like crossing, like osmosis, crossing over and then deciding, whoa, we're coming back.
Yeah.
And that's a weird, fascinating thing to have experienced, but also not to be able to really grip onto it fully. And maybe I'll never grip onto it fully. Death is what the greatest mystery.
And no one that's the whole point. Yeah.
No one has an explanation.
Maybe as humans, we can't cope with that sort of raw reality.
Yeah.
The fact that
you mentioned ayahuasca, right? And ayahuasca basically is a plant that, for those of you who aren't familiar, South America, very popular among shamans. And the plant, the active ingredient is DMT.
Dimethyltryptamine.
Yeah, dimethyltryptamine, which actually gets released from your pineal gland at the time of death. So it's found in the highest concentrations the moment the moment you die. So
I didn't know that.
If ever you do decide that you want to do that, please come back and tell us if that experience was similar. Because that's what I've read about. So at the moment that you're about, from your pineal gland, it's released, DMT. That's why they call it the spirit molecule.
That's why also there's that association that some have made with the Egyptians and the eye.
The eye of Horus looks like a pineal gland.
Looks like the pineal gland, yeah. But I mean, the fact, how did they know it back then? I mean, how did they build the pyramids?
How did they build the pyramids?
My favorite, not my favorite pyramid story, my favorite story about that time in Egypt is that, because I love honey, and they found like 3,000-year-old honey in one of the pharaoh's tombs. So I'm a big advocate for like raw honey. I know it's a really random comment to make, but I always love the fact that like honey doesn't expire and it's an antioxidant and it has antioxidative properties, I guess. It's not an antioxidant. But the fact that honey was found in the pharaoh's tomb, there's some stuff there, guys. Yeah, go buy yourself some
3,000. 3,000 years. Yeah, well, look, we've talked about the actual experience, but I think your story is one of inspiration and hope. And I think more importantly, I'd like to discuss the life after. Because, yes, we know you've got the prosthesis now, and I'm sure that took some time to get used to.
And still does, you know?
Still does. So how many years now have you got the prosthesis?
I will be the prosthesis. I will have been amputee for 10 years in June, and a prosthetic wearer, 9 years, let's say 9.5 years.
Okay. Yeah. And how soon after did you feel like you were ready to just be integrated back into normal life after that incident? So the June holidays happened, I'm sure you had a few surgeries. Just one. They just fashioned the stump.
Yeah. So I probably have to go for revision surgery because you're... You get, they call them dog ears, like you get like little flaps of skin because of the swelling obviously goes down, and you obviously have where they've closed off. So my skin was pulled over and back, so sewed up from the back.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So I think with me, there's a little bit of bone growth, I think, on the one edge, which has caused a little bit of bruising, but I don't know. I'm curious just to I want to get to life after the attack and things. Yeah, but from a bone growth perspective, I found out last year I did an x-ray because I've had some bruising on my leg, and for a long time it was bad and then it kind of subsided. So part of that could be the hardware. So your socket and prosthetic could be causing too much constriction at the base of the leg, and you get hematoma or you've got impact. No above the knee amputee though has a lot of impact on the base of their leg. A lot of it's on the ischium, and kind of spread out throughout the socket. So we weight bear more on the ischium than not fully on the ischium, but there's no weight bearing on the base of the stump.
Oh, okay.
Which is also such a weird word. I find stump such a like residual limb is a like the right word, but there's no right word, right? Like it is a stump, but it also still I have to also still consider it my right leg. I can't just be like, oh, it's just a stump now. Like that's the one of the things that they said to me when I started doing rehabilitation at the prosthetic practice, the orthotics and prosthetics practice, Chin and Partners. They said you have to kind of make friends with your leg again. Kind of don't be scared to touch it. And I mean, I have to moisturize this leg every single night because it dries out in the silicone liner. Whereas the rest of my body can be ashy, but this can't be. I didn't look at you specifically. but we'll make a joke. Just
breathe.
Back for the Prince Albert thing, and also you can't see your knees. You have long pants on. But yeah, I don't know where I kind of
tell me, you must have been one of the younger people at the prosthetic clinic, right?
Yes, so I was in hospital for 10 days only. So the infection, luckily my body was strong, I was young, the infection didn't spread, in this leg. I mean, I nearly had my ACL ripped.
Yeah.
It was so close.
So what happened on that leg?
Also a laceration.
But how did that happen? At what point? When he came around the second time?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but we think it was on the second impact. So I did feel impact on my left side with the second return.
Yeah.
So I had a brace with a. You can control the degrees of how far you can bend your leg, and slowly, yeah, they were able to like increase it, so I could start moving my leg. But in the beginning, I couldn't move my leg, so I was in the bed for about 3 days. And one of the things that never happened to me in the hospital bed was I never used a bedpan. I had a catheter, which was also just very strange. I never used a catheter, and to feel the catheter come out of you, it's also just bizarre. I don't know if you have ever had a catheter.
No. We put a lot in, take them out.
Like, it's so. Just you're just putting a straw into a milkshake. But you must just try it for yourself one of these days. It feels like, you know, when you sweat, you don't feel your sweat, like your urine just leaves your body. You just feel, you just see this thing fill up with your pee. And I remember, like, this is my first time in hospital as well, besides for when I was born.
Lord have mercy.
So sorry. I've gone into a bit of detail, but these are the things that you have to deal with when you're in the hospital.
Yeah.
But yeah, in hospital for 10 days and then home to my town, who were, I mean, Prince Albert's, they were so supportive. Just when I was at hospital, helping my family, helping fundraise as well for a prosthetic for me.
Yeah.
And then my university, the sort of HOD of the department, they said to my dad when he called and, you know, was just checking in about, you know, if I can continue, they said, well, we'll just let him come back, and we'll just adapt, and he can just adapt around us. So I dropped my elective, so I didn't go to upper campus, just went to heading campus every single day. And I went back in 2 weeks into the new term, so I went back to my same class. I'd missed about 2-3 weeks of the new university semester.
And just I'm assuming everyone was supportive. Just
yeah, also just surprised, like, why are you here, you know?
And did you have a prosthetic?
No. So I still had too much swelling. I think my stitches had just come out, and also staples.
Yeah.
And my mom, back to my mother, my mom left the school for 6 months. My brother was doing a sabbatical, so he went and ran the school, like managed the school for my mother.
Yeah.
My mom picked me up and dropped me off every single day at varsity, and then took me to the clinic to do my rehabilitation. And then that's when I got into the pool and started swimming. So there was really no stopping. And back to your question about, you know, when did you feel ready to reintegrate? I think you're never really ready. I don't think I was ever fully ready. Like, what does ready mean? I suppose when do you feel confident enough? Maybe when do you feel like you can get back up? When I was in the hospital, I started doing exercises start moving my body and to start like shifting things, because I wanted to get going. I don't think I fully grasped life as an amputee and what that was going to look like, but no one does. I don't think when you've overcome something like this. So I think for me it was just taking action and getting going.
Yeah.
So very short time in hospital, and then was very, very disciplined with my rehabilitation. And
yeah.
I lost 14 kilograms, which was also, which is a lot of weight to lose. But and I think a lot of it was the limb.
And I mean, you think with all the stress that would come with, you know, just this whole life change, you think you would gain weight, you know?
You think so?
I think so. I really think, I mean...
Well, some people, I mean, through stress, the cortisol, all of that.
Yeah, you know, and spending more... Because, yes, the event happened.
Maybe
yes.
Were you quite sedentary, or were you still trying to move and be active?
Me.
Yeah.
No, move.
You were trying to move.
Yeah, even when I went to Prince Albert's, every day I did some dips. I remember doing some dips. I remember trying to do my own push-ups and things, like doing a little bit of movement every single day. But it was uncomfortable because you made a note about the, you know, phantom limb pain there. So you can still feel your right leg. You've got this bandage, which every day or every second day you have to really clean. Wash it, use antiseptic, put the Steri-Strips, are they called Steri-Strips? Or those little micropore strips that you put back over the stitches.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Let it breathe. And then also just, it was always very warm. Like, it's busy healing, lots of blood there. And and then you're also coming to terms with this thing that feels like, it's because it's swollen and healing, it just feels uncomfortable. Yeah. So it was an uncomfortable time, but I was surrounded by a really good team of people. Mm-hmm. I had a great hospital I could go to. I had physio exercises I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I had my family who, mm-hmm. till this day, are well. By my side and very supportive.
So with the prosthetic, like, I see you walking normally, like, it's, you look good functionally. Are there any limitations with it?
Yes, so there's no ankle flexion. There's no neural connection to the knee. So I can't kick your right knee. I can't. I have to do this. Sorry for kicking you. Just
That's fine. Don't hurt.
I can't run really with this leg. Yeah. So I would need a blade. So there's always a joke with amputees. If you're below the knee, a lot of amputees always go like, oh, you just got a scratch because you've got your knee. So the higher up your amputation, I mean, someone who has like hip disarticulation or doesn't have a hip has a prosthetic that goes all the way up into, and that actually almost sits in the socket, will tell me that I've also just got a scratch. So there's degrees of of severity, obviously, with your amputation, but not having a knee does suck, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I haven't run for 10 years almost. Like, that's a weird concept as well, to like tell someone you're not gonna run again for 10 years. Like,
Imagine. I mean, there are people out there that are just like, why would I want to
with
run?
Both legs?
With both legs. Like, run,
for those that do run, for those that do exercise and move their bodies.
You also mentioned something about swimming.
Yes, so that was probably the best thing. And anyone who has got an injury that is anything physical, I really recommend, if you can, if your body allows it, to get into a pool. It was the best thing I think I did for my exercise.
And then you went on to surf. How did that happen?
So swimming started first, and I started competing in swimming as well, which was really great. And the para swimming community is under-supported, but has a gigantic heart and very inspirational people. And then I was invited to the first ever South African Adaptive Surfing Champs. So adaptive surfing is just the para-athletics version of able-bodied surfing, called adaptive surfing or para-surfing. And South Africa was hosting its first one at Musenberg Beach. So I went because a few weeks ago before that, my brother and sister went for a surfing lesson, and the instructor just said, well, come with us, we'll put you on a longboard, and I just enjoy the challenge, and I suppose rose to the challenge and just continued to do it. And yeah, it was an opportunity as well to also qualify and go to World Champs to surf. So I surfed for South Africa and in the States. So that I never thought I'd represent my country in a sport, which is less about, you know, oh, look at me and how cool I am, but just like, what a cool opportunity. And again, I've been exposed to the world of, let's call it disability, people that have overcome things and have lost limbs and arms and eyes and different kinds of things. And it's a group of people and stories that I would have never been exposed to. You know, that we all had the Oscar Pistorius story, right? And we've got the
You guys must hate him.
Hey, we aren't friends at the moment. No, we've never met. I've never met him, and I've you know, I'm never really associated with his story.
Good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, but the Paralympics is the sort of flagship thing that everyone knows, outside of having a friend that has a disability or knowing someone's story. So it's quite a niche little world. Like all the and it's like not everyone's a doctor, right? I mean, I'm not saying that this is on the same level as that. You can't really compare them, but not everyone knows what it's like to work with a patient and to, like, you guys insert catheters, you know, like, you know, like all those little things you guys do and all the little things that make your job quite unique. It's a similar thing with that community of people. Like, they all adapt. They all have different things that they do. And to learn and grow alongside them has been quite an awesome journey. I've really met some cool people along the way, both able-bodied and differently
that's,
able.
That's amazing.
It's also very impressive that you went back into the water.
I was just going to say
no
that.
No PTSD, nothing.
Nothing. Like, you've never had flashbacks maybe when you
have. I have. Yeah, I've had moments in the water where someone will just bump me and I'll just freak out completely and I'm like, whoa, I need to get out. I've had a moment before, I think twice, where I've just felt uncomfortable, surfing at Musenberg and went in and the shark siren went off. So there's also like,
sure,
you know, there's that intuitive thing I think we all have as well. And I just, it's just, I suppose, quite a coincidence that I've had those moments and there's been a shark in the water and I haven't felt comfortable and I've gone in. So, like, but I definitely
you,
have.
You know how crazy that would be as if, imagine you fall off a building. Like if I ever fell off a building, I'm not even taking the escalator anymore. Yeah. I'm on the ground floor for the rest of my life. But you were like, I'm not just going to swim. That's what you I'm going to go back out into the ocean to the place where I suppose one of the scariest, or if not the scariest thing that has ever happened in my life. And a lot of people, I'm just thinking about this now on a more philosophical level. Like,
yes,
most people go through trauma or go through pain and they're like, I never want to be anywhere close to this ever again in any scenario, shape, way or form. And you were like, I'm going to go back there.
Yeah. Well, Caleb, have you been back to that same beach?
No, so I was going to say, so just on that point, I think I was supported and encouraged to get back into the ocean. Mm. Not forced, but encouraged. And I think it's hard. I never really always look at it from someone else's perspective, but it must be, I wouldn't know what to say to myself if my brother had lost his leg. I don't know if I would have said to him, hey, you should go back to the to the beach, man.
Yeah.
But there was just, I think other shark attack survivors had spoken to me, water people, you know, they call them water people, just people that are surfers, love the ocean, you know, people that spend time there. Just, I think the ocean has, I think, it's philosophical, Mother Nature, but the ocean has that's not my phone. Mother Nature has healing, has the ability to heal, has the ability to help us process and heal. And I think going back to the sea and water, and I love the philosophy around it, because 27th of June, I was reborn. When you are born, you are in your mother's womb. You are in water. I was reborn in the ocean. And I continue to go back to that space because there's a bit of magic there, I think, that I have experienced both the dark and the light. Yeah. And there's no anger there. So if there's no anger, can there be processing? So I choose to process. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been back to Buffalo Bay. And it sat with me quite a bit because if I'm in Cape Town, I'm 5 hours from Buffalo Bay. Mm. If I'm in Prince Albert, I'm 2.5 hours from Buffalo Bay. I've been to George many times. I've driven on swimming trips past Buffalo Bay, but I'm going to go back, and I'm thinking of doing it next year, which will be the 11th year, which is an angel number. Mm. I'm a March baby. I'm 11, so I'm Pisces.
Yeah.
Water sign, more philosophy.
Just more philosophy.
Let's start crying with the Kleenex tissues, man. So I think how I see this as well, like, we have to make meaning from, well, I've chosen to find meaning through what I've experienced. Yeah. I think if you can do that and not, it's helped me just to go, this, not that this happened for a reason, but this happened and there's meaning here.
Yeah.
There's stuff that's been given to you. You've been given a baton and you can choose to hand it over to the next person. But I was thinking about it today, like, am I going to get resentful one day? Am I going to get angry? Am I going to be like, well, fuck this, man. I'm done with this shit. Like, I don't know. Mm. I don't know. But right now, I don't have those feelings. I definitely have my microaggressions where it's just a tough day, or my leg is just sore, or I can't fall asleep, or I've had to do a DIY situation, or I pinched something, so now I've got a bit of an infection. And there was a time a year ago where I couldn't walk for 3 months because of bruising. That was horrible. And I was on crutches. 3 months. And how do you shop with crutches? Mm. Like, how do you go to the shops and bring back groceries? Something so simple that someone in a wheelchair, it's their everyday, not even challenge, it's what they just live with. So I also, everything is relative. I'm also grateful that I still have my left leg and I have my hands and that I'm fit and that I'm mildly good looking, so I can still, you know, act, I guess. Well, these things help you, you know. And also I'm a confident person.
Yeah.
I think it's like, you know, when you say to someone, oh yeah, you're good looking, and I'm like, oh, then you say to me, nah, that's not true. But like, we've all saying you have a great beard, Got a great hairline and a great fade.
Yo, oh, thanks. Great hairline.
Great hairline. That's sponsored, actually.
Sponsored by.
But, the Gents Clinic.
But I think sometimes often we don't tell the truth. Mm. So, like, you might say, ask me something, do you have any fears? And I might just want to have this brave face and just go, nah, since 2015, everything's been Gucci and I'm just this inspirational person that has no flaws. But I think we are all flawed and broken and all healing. I know it's very emotional maybe or philosophical, but this has definitely changed me. It's definitely made me more sensitive. It's definitely made me grapple with trauma. Like I did one of my research pieces at university about somatic healing and trauma, because I believe that through movement and through shifting the body and combining that with something I guess that's didactic or written, there can be processing there. Breath work is a good example of that. If you just get still, stuff comes out of the darkness.
That's a lot of philosophy right there.
That's all the time we have for today, Caleb, unfortunately. But I really appreciated you coming through and chatting to us. I hope we can have you back again soon, because I have so many more questions. But,
yeah, we actually had quite a lot.
If I spoke too much. No.
Unfortunately.
You guys didn't ask me to come speak.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why you're here.
Well, we didn't come to ask you to run. So, I mean.
Well, but also just to you, thanks for having me. And yeah. I think it's really cool to sit down with a group of lads and just chat. I don't think it happens happens enough, and it's a positive, beautiful thing, you know. So also just appreciate you guys letting me come into your space. Sure.
And we appreciate you. We really do. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with us. I definitely think we'll have another opportunity for you to come back and share a lot more of your insights in the future. That's been another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. My name is Dr. Sohail Essa signing off.
Dr. Nassim Sharif.
Caleb, the amputee. Thank you. Bye.
We'll catch you next week. Cheers.